Welcome to the Atlantic Council Events Podcast. The Atlantic Council serves the global community by bringing together world leaders, foreign policy experts, and great thinkers to shape today's policy choices and navigate the global challenges of the 21st century. On June 27, 2016, in light of Britain's historic vote to leave the European Union, the Atlantic Council discussed what the US, UK, and crucial European allies must do to bolster NATO's strength and solidarity, especially in a post-Brexit Europe. We also launched a report on restoring the power and purpose of the NATO alliance, authored by Ambassador R. Nicholas Burns and General James L. Jones, who presented their final conclusions. The event was moderated by Evelyn Farkas.
Good afternoon, everyone. Why don't we go ahead and get started? My name is Damon Wilson. I'm Executive Vice President at the Atlantic Council, and I'm delighted to welcome you here today for the launch of a very important report on NATO. We're here 4 days after the British electorate has decided that the United Kingdom would leave the European Union. And while we're all still trying to digest the outcome and understand what it means and what the implications are, I think our community here at the Atlantic Council believes one thing is for certain, that no matter what, our alliance will become more important. It will be the glue that helps keep us together, both across the Atlantic, within Europe, and the vehicle to help defend our way of lives. So we're here today to talk about a report restoring NATO's power and purpose that was led by two great Americans who serve on the Atlantic Council's board, General Jim Jones and Ambassador Nick Burns. Thank you to both of you for your leadership. Thank you both of you for your service and for being with us today. We're delighted that they're joining us for a conversation, which one of our senior fellows, Evelyn Farkas, will help lead in just a minute. We're here for this conversation on NATO after Brexit, and we're being joined by a much larger audience online and on TV. And we encourage all of you to contribute to this conversation, submit your thoughts, your questions, using the hashtag FutureNATO, but also the hashtag StrongerWithAllies, because that is what we believe here. Today's product is a result of an Atlantic Council strategy. About a year ago, we set out to look at what's happening on both sides of the Atlantic. Concerned about America's role in the world, and our ability and desire and will to continue to play a leadership role, but at the same time, what was happening in Europe as forces of fragmentation were undermining the sense of solidarity among our allies in Europe. Brexit has delivered that message in very sharp terms. But what brings these two sets of issues together is that we come together through NATO, through our alliance. So in the context of this uncertainty, the issue of Brexit, the uncertainty of where the European project is headed, we do believe the U.S. role in Europe is going to become even more important to help ensure a sense of predictability. I'm going to leave the report to Ambassador Burns and General Jones to lay out their conclusions and findings and key themes, but I wanted to put it in context of four reasons why the Atlantic Council moved forward on this report at this time. One, even before the latest debate, there was a concern about perhaps the marginalization of NATO, that it was no longer really at the center of our national security and foreign policy. There's a lot of talk about NATO as them. If you sit in Washington, we refer to them across the Atlantic. If you sit in Europe, they refer to them as the Americans. If you don't own this alliance, it will wither. And I think that's one of the points we wanted to make, a call for leadership and imagination, particularly American leadership. Second, we're headed to Warsaw, which will prove to be a very significant summit for this alliance. But our point is that what's happening right now in terms of European security, uncertainty of the world, we need to be prepared for the long term. This is not just deterrence over a short period. And if you look at our budgets, you look at political resolve, we're not yet postured for the long-term reality we face. And I think we worry, is our response commensurate with the challenges that we face when you look to the east, when you look to the south, when you look to internal challenges? Third, there's beginning to be the remnants of a very strong narrative playing out across Europe today. It's the broken promises narrative that President Putin used in the wake of the annexation of Crimea, that we broke our promises to Russia and therefore justifying Russia's actions. So you hear today in Europe that NATO exercises in Poland, the Baltic states, that Warsaw's strategy is provocative. And yet I think we felt that there was a problem, that if we couldn't actually exercise, if we couldn't actually demonstrate the reality of our ability to protect our allies in the East, that we would be negligent of our responsibilities. And so I think that will be a coming theme we'll see play out as a way to frame the public perception. Is Warsaw doing what's responsible, Or is it provocative overreach and beginning to make the case for the easing even of sanctions against Russia when we go through our own transition? And finally, in our own debate, the Atlantic Council has been one of the strong voices calling on our European allies, Canadian allies, to do more in terms of their own defense investment. That will continue. But if our only debate and prism through that, through the alliance in the United States, is one of burden sharing, we're going to undermine that sense of understanding of the value of our alliances. And we believe fundamentally our alliances are force multipliers for our values and our interests, and that it's one of our greatest strategic assets that our adversaries only wish they had. So with that, I'm going to invite Evelyn Farkas up to the stage, one of our fellows who is a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense at the Pentagon, a strong voice on these issues both in and out of government, and a former key advisor to NATO SACEURS to help moderate our conversation. I'll invite General Jim Jones and Ambassador Burns to join her. General Jones was the chair of the Atlantic Council itself, obviously former National Security Advisor for the purposes of this report, a former Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. He currently is the chairman of the Brent Scowcroft Center at the Atlantic Council and head of the Jones Group. Ambassador Nick Burns, who also serves on the Atlantic Council board, served as Undersecretary for Political Affairs in addition to being our permanent representative to the NATO alliance, and our ambassador to Greece is currently a professor at Harvard. With that, let me turn it over to Evelyn to get the conversation started. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Damon, and thank you, all of you, for being here today. I am very honored to be here with these two gentlemen to discuss this report. I think it's quite timely. I'm hoping that maybe through this report and through this discussion, we can transform the discussion and make the discussion about NATO and institutions a little bit more sizzling, and perhaps we can make these two gentlemen like the Spice Boys of internationalism. So we're going to try to keep it a
Not
little
possible.
Light and interesting, because if Bernie Sanders can do it, I think you guys can too.
Oh, God.
So let's make it a little more conventional and approachable. And I think it's important just to kind of spring forward a little bit and use some of the words that Damon discussed about values and defending our way of life. I think this report, while it looks like a very dry, you know, the usual pre-summit kind of report on NATO, right? And both of you have.
It's not how we see it.
Okay. Good. Okay. So both of you have read a lot of these reports. But the reality is, I think what doesn't convey often when we have these conversations is it's really about our values. Why do we have these institutions? Why do we have collective security? First of all, you have to have some understanding of the history, you know, what we're trying to prevent. But it's also about spreading democracy, strengthening democracy, protecting our economic freedom of navigation, freedom of commerce. These things are not to be taken for granted. And without strong alliances, without a military, indeed, without deterrence, without defense, you cannot have all of those economic things, the prosperity, and then, of course, democracy. So that's kind of my two cents, but you're not here to listen to me. You're here to listen to the sizzling Spice Boys. So I think you each have 5 minutes to give sort of your synopsis or just the high points, you know, the things that you think are most important about the report. I have a few questions for you, and then I'm sure these folks have also very interesting questions and comments. So over to you, Ambassador Burns.
Thank you very much, Evelyn, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. First, I want to say thank you to the Atlantic Council. I told Fred and Damon earlier, it's the fastest growing think tank in Washington. And when Fred and Damon took it over, it had fallen on hard times. It's now, I think, one of our most influential centers for learning and for debate in Washington. So congratulations to Fred and Damon and David Ensor and everyone else at the Atlantic Council. Second, I wanted to say what a pleasure it's been to work with General Jones, Jim, over the last 8 months on this report. We worked together at NATO at a tough time after 9/11 during the Iraq and Afghan wars, and I have tremendous respect for Jim and thank him for his continued leadership. Why did we write the report? We believe that NATO and the European Union, the European allies, are facing the greatest set of challenges since the end of the Cold War 25 years ago when the Soviet Union imploded December 25th, 1991. I never thought we'd come back to this time. I was serving in the administration of George H.W. Bush on the NSC on Soviet affairs, and we felt liberated from the Cold War, from the threat of imminent destruction. And the words of President Bush 41, Europe had become whole, free, and at peace. And that was our strategic mantra through the Clinton administration, through the George W. Bush administration, and into the Obama administration. That all changed in March of 2014 when President Putin decided that he would invade Crimea and annex it, and then to divide Ukraine and the Donbass after having invaded Georgia in 2008. So this report is underlined by some strategic trend lines that we find very negative, both for the United States and Canada, as well as for Europe. First is this redivision of Europe by the Russian Federation, the search, as the Tsars did, for strategic depth. And that's why they went into Georgia. That's why they've intimidated Armenia and Azerbaijan. That's why they've divided Ukraine, the false territorial conflict in Moldova, and now the current pressure on the Baltic states. It requires a response from NATO. And so the number one recommendation that I think is important in this report is NATO should station troops permanently in the Baltic countries, in Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, permanently in Poland, permanently in Romania and Bulgaria and the Black Sea, and have a capacity to act on the air and the sea in both the Black Sea and Baltic regions. This is not warmongering. That's what the Russian Federation, the Putin government, wants you to believe. Damon and I were in Europe last week in Brussels and Berlin together, and the Russians are out saying NATO's provoking a crisis. These are clearly modest, in terms of the troop commitments, measures designed to stabilize the alliance, protect our smaller allies in the east, and do what the NATO alliance has to do, protect the member states and collective security in Europe. And we need to establish effective deterrence against Putin. And that's why our number one recommendation is the permanent basing of NATO troops in those areas. Second, the United States and Canada and Europe should maintain the economic sanctions on Russia. Those sanctions are now in question. Prime Minister Renzi went to the St. Petersburg summit and said we ought to trade more with Russia. President Hollande says we should question these sanctions and maybe take them off in December. There's a big debate in Germany, and we saw it in Berlin on Thursday and Friday between, say, two political parties, the SPD and the CDU, or whether they should maintain sanctions against the Russian Federation. The Europeans will extend them this week, but in December, right in the middle of our presidential transition, some Europeans want to make a move to return to business as usual with Russia. I think, thankfully, Chancellor Merkel has been giving every indication, and she negotiated the Minsk understandings with President Putin, that unless he adheres to them to the letter, Germany, under her leadership, is not going to relax the sanctions. But there's going to be a big battle in Europe, and I think a battle across the Atlantic on this issue. And we believe sanctions should be maintained. That's what effective deterrence is. Third, obviously, we've got to have a stronger NATO as we move forward with deterring the Russian Federation and President Putin. And right now, exactly five of the allies of 28 spend more than 2% of GDP in defense. That is the floor, by the way. Those are the minimal expectations. It used to be 3%, that you spend 2% of GDP in defense. And it is true that 20 of the allies have inched up in their defense spending, but not many close to 2%. And so we believe that Germany, at 1.1% of its GDP, Spain, Italy, the Netherlands, need to do more in response to the crisis in Europe. When Donald Trump, and it pains me to say this because I'm opposed to Donald Trump, has hit a chord with the American public that somehow we're being taken advantage of because our allies don't spend enough on defense, then that maybe is incentive for the Europeans to do more for their own defense and collectively in NATO. We also have other recommendations, and that is to be much more proficient in our cyber capabilities, to fully deploy missile defense, to be active to NATO's south in places like Morocco and Tunisia and Jordan and Iraq, in training the Arab forces at their request in these countries. There's a big set of challenges ahead, and we believe it requires American leadership. And I'll end on this point. We're the leader of this alliance, the United States of America. We always have been, and the alliance desperately needs leadership. When President Obama goes to the Warsaw Summit in 10 days' time, he's going to be going there in the wake of this very dramatic, consequential, historic British vote to leave the European Union. And while it's too early to know exactly where this is leading, because some Brits want to have a second referendum and to counteract the first, if Britain does leave, we are looking potentially at a fractured United Kingdom with the Scotland question and the Irish question coming back a century later to bedevil constitutionally the future of the United Kingdom, we certainly are going to need to see the United States embrace the United Kingdom in our special relationship. It's the fifth largest economy in the world. It's the second strongest military in NATO. We'll still be able to work with them in NATO, but we won't have the British to be the tough-minded, pragmatic voice within EU councils on issues like, do you continue sanctions against Russia? And so therefore, and we talked about this in Berlin in a public forum on Friday morning, the United States is going to have to seek a deeper relationship with Germany. Germany, the dominant country in the European Union with the most respected leader in Europe, Angela Merkel, that relationship, I think, is one that we'll have to build further in this administration and in the next. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick. And Evelyn, thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. I'd like to also echo the importance of this report and certainly acknowledge the my predecessor, twice removed at NATO, General George Jowen, who's here, former SACEUR, a mentor, a great friend to all of us who are privileged to follow in his footsteps. And I'd also like to underscore the work of Jeff Lightfoot in writing this report. Jeff, thank you very much. Your performance was extraordinary. So I think NATO, this NATO summit sees NATO facing four strategic challenges. The first one is obviously Nick has covered with regard to Russia. The chaos and the disorder emanating from the Middle East, a less than certain U.S. leadership and engagement policy, which doesn't just start with this administration, it actually started before this administration, and then a European Union that is at best weakened, maybe fatally so, time will tell. If Wales summit in 2014 was about reassurance, the Warsaw summit of 2016 is about deterrence. And there are a lot of people talking about deterrence and dialogue, and I think as Nick Burns correctly pointed out just a few minutes ago in a private lunch, that if you want to have effective dialogue, the first thing you need is to have effective deterrence. Otherwise, there's not much of a conversation. So I think that's extremely important, and I'm pleased to see the shift towards deterrence. The highlight of the summit will be NATO's enhanced forward presence of the four battalions stationed in each of the Baltic countries and Poland, and also the use of the bases in Romania and Bulgaria. The U.S. quadrupling European reassurance funds to $3.4 billion is also extremely helpful. And the fact that NATO is moving to declare cyber an official domain is also, I think, quite useful. But I think, as the report points out, that NATO's activities and levels of ambition need more emphasis in certain areas. And the first one that comes to my mind is what NATO is going to be used for in the 21st century. And the simple paradigm here is, if NATO was a defensive reactive alliance in the 20th century, in the 21st century, given the nature of the threats that face us and the speed at which these threats are coming at us, it seems to me that NATO must become a more proactive alliance. And by that, I don't mean starting wars or triggering wars everywhere. I mean preventing wars. Preventing predictable disasters from happening so that we wind up in another Afghanistan and another Iraq for a decade or more. This proactivity, I think, speaks well to an enhanced program involving partners that General Jowen started years ago. And I think we need to do more of that, but on a grander scale. Migration is a big problem, and it's causing incredible tensions politically, and it may have had something to do with Brexit as well, obviously. But preventing this uncontrolled movement of millions of people is something that I think a grand alliance of 28 countries should be focused on and should be doing something about, and preventing those kinds of colossal movements of people is something that we should worry about. And I think NATO's first job is to enhance the security of itself and also to help other like-minded countries in Africa and other developing countries figure out how to assure their own security so they can move into economic development, governance, and rule of law. So I think this proactivity is a new word in NATO, and I'm glad to see that it's included in the report because I think it speaks well to what NATO can and should be in the 21st century. Spending, I think Nick covered very well. If we don't achieve this 2% of GDP, shame on us. I mean, this was agreed to in the Prague summit of 2002, and it's now 2016, and we still have too many countries falling short of what they agreed to many, many years ago. And frankly, if we don't achieve that, NATO's credibility, I think, is suspect. U.S. leadership, I want to just dwell on that for a little bit. It is clear that that U.S. leadership, I think, day in and day out over the history of NATO has been essential. It doesn't mean that it's dictatorial. It doesn't mean that we talk down to our allies, but it means that a U.S. president has to be engaged in what NATO is about. We cannot simply walk away from a 28-member nation alliance, 27 including us, and pretend that it is not useful. It is terribly useful. And the potential for NATO in the rest of this century, and certainly as far ahead as I can see, is tremendous. But it has to be used correctly, and it won't be unless the sitting U.S. president devotes a fair amount of time to making sure that the Secretary General of NATO is recognized almost at head of state level and is as important an ally as any single country. The NATO Secretary General walks into the Oval Office, he brings the voice of 27 sovereign countries. That's important. And how we react to that is also very important. So I would hope that this summit will see a reassertion of U.S. Firm commitment to not only supporting the alliance, leading the alliance, and also making sure that the members live up to what they've agreed to do. And finally, the NATO-EU relationship is always one that has been slightly uncomfortable. We've never really figured out how those two organizations coexist, mostly at the political level. This is not a military problem. The militaries know how to solve this problem extremely well. It just remains to see if it's politically acceptable. But we cannot afford to have two separate militaries and two separate hierarchies of those militaries. And we've proven that in the Balkans, and I think it could militarily be proven again. So I would say that especially at this time, it's very important for the United States leadership and NATO and the EU to come together and really figure this out once and for all. And I think it's possible. So those would be the points that I would make by way of an opening bid.
That's great. So I'll leave out the names, but well before the Wales summit, a very high-ranking NATO official said to a very high-ranking U.S. official, deterrence before dialogue. And I think it was interesting that there was transatlantic unity on that, at least among these individuals. And so we're seeing that now coming to fruition. What I'm going to do is ask kind of a macro question, and then you guys can cherry pick a little bit from this macro question in the interest of saving time and also getting a few other things out there into the discussion, which the audience can pick up upon if they would like. It's clear that really, if you had to take all these 10 recommendations, the two most important ones are leadership and being proactive. Because if you have those two elements, you can take care of the other eight. There are a couple other items, and of course, you can't fit everything into one report. And you did touch upon some of these lightly, even in your comments here, both of you. But there are three other areas where I think we want to think about how we can use leadership and be proactive. One of them has to do with expansion. So I think if I were to, you know, make a recommendation to the heads of state going into the new summit, the Warsaw summit, I would say make a big deal about the fact that you're expanding. And Damon has said this before, you know, insecure institutions don't expand. They don't allow new members in if they're feeling insecure. And so I think the fact that Montenegro is being admitted into NATO, while of course it's a small country and it's not going to contribute phenomenally, you know, I should say, to NATO's defense, still it will contribute to its own defense, and it has been contributing all along to NATO operations in Afghanistan and elsewhere. So I think the question of expansion is important because right now, you mentioned the dialogue, the Russians pushing back, Ambassador Burns, they are pushing back also on NATO expansion, saying, well, this is somehow a move against Russia, it's countering Russia. When in reality, and both of you know very well because you lived through this, NATO expansion was actually aimed at spreading security and stability throughout Europe. And as such, it's an unfinished piece of business for NATO. So I think if you would like to comment on that, it would be useful, because I think we still have four aspirants, and of course potential aspirants out there. And so if you have a message for them. The other element that is touched upon a bit in the report but could be fleshed out is the issue of hybrid warfare, unconventional warfare, little green men or demonstrators. And that's where the EU comes into play because, of course, if you have anything that requires law enforcement and strategic communications, those are areas that NATO does not have competency in and really would have to work closely with the EU on. Now, I believe that at the summit in Warsaw, they'll make a statement about that, but I'd be interested whether either of you have any comments on that, on what more we could do in that area, and in particular working with the EU. And then finally, General, you mentioned being proactive in the Middle East and Africa, and I think hanging, and you mentioned the refugees, hanging over all of us here is really the catastrophe that is Syria, the cause of the refugee flow. Is there something that NATO could or should be doing? So those are kind of my three big ideas out there. You can pick and choose as you like. Ambassador, I'll start with you.
In 1 minute or less, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm not going to try to answer all your questions. Some I think are probably better for Jim as a military leader to answer. But let me just say a couple of things. First, it was really striking to be in Europe last week. Damon and I went to Brussels to present this report to the Secretary General of NATO and to a lot of the ambassadors and to the public, and went to Berlin to do the same thing. The Europeans are, some of them, quite reluctant to be too truculent with President Putin. So the bumper sticker that's going to emerge at the Warsaw Summit 10 days from now on Russia is deterrence and dialogue. And many of the Europeans were advising us, you Americans need to believe in those two equally. My response was, I don't think so. I don't worry about dialogue with the Russian Federation. Secretary of State John Kerry, whom I deeply admire, is on the phone constantly with Sergei Lavrov. There is no absence of discussion between the US and Russia. There's an absence of productive work on the part of the Russian Federation. And I guess one of the things I learned as a diplomat is that you most often can succeed in diplomacy when your position is strong strategically. And so deterrence, moving troops into the Baltic states, moving troops, and by the way, these are very modest levels, but to show President Putin that we're going to be true to our Article 5 commitment to protect these countries should that be necessary, that's vital. And if he believes that we are powerful and unafraid to exercise that power, he'll be much more likely to engage in productive dialogue. So my advice to our German friends, we were on a panel with Wolfgang Ischinger, who is a great friend of ours, was they're both important, deterrence and dialogue, but deterrence at this stage, given what Putin has just done, is much more important. Mm-hmm. We need to stand up to Putin, and I hope that will be the message from Warsaw. Second, there's a very aggressive Russian propaganda campaign, very well financed, underway across Europe, trying to insinuate that it's the United States that has caused the problems presently in Europe, not Russia. So I was personally dismayed when the German Foreign Minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, said publicly a week ago Saturday, that NATO exercises in the Baltic states were saber-rattling. It's exactly what the Russians want the European publics to believe. But fortunately, Angela Merkel came out in a press conference on Wednesday, and she said she supported these exercises, and she felt that Germany should, for the first time, put together a plan to get to 2% of GDP on German defense spending in the future, which was a very welcome message. saber-rattling. To accuse the NATO allies of protecting their own territory is not saber-rattling. The saber-rattling, it's more than saber-rattling, was the invasion of Crimea and the division of the Donbass and the invasion of Georgia. So
and the nuclear saber-rattling.
Well, and the fact that the Russian Federation, exactly, Evelyn, has withdrawn from the Conventional Forces in Europe treaty, mm-hmm. is not respecting any of the corpus of arms agreements that we negotiated in the 80s, 90s, and after 2001 to try to secure Europe. Russia has walked away from it. The United States has not walked away from any of its commitments.
So, and INF, don't forget INF.
And INF, which was the great Gorbachev-Ronald Reagan Treaty of 1987. And so I think we have to be clear about what the problem is. And we may have witnessed in Germany the opening of the German elections in 2017. My German friends kept telling me, well, Steinmeier only said that because of the elections. I said, yeah, but you don't want to play into Russian hands. And so it's very important that we Americans have enough self-confidence to be clear about what we're trying to do and protect security in Europe, our own vital interests there, and those of the Europeans. Last on NATO expansion. Montenegro will come in, which is a very positive development. And positive in tangible terms for them, symbolic terms for the rest of us. We've always been an open alliance of democracies. We never said this, but underlining NATO history is a repudiation of Yalta. Mm-hmm. We're not going to trade one country's future over their heads with the Russians. We're not going to do that on Georgia. We shouldn't. And we shouldn't do it on Ukraine. And since the end of the Cold War, I think all of us in every administration, Republican and Democrat, have believed that every European nation should get to choose, have the right to choose its future. And NATO enlargement was demand-driven. And a lot of us here in this room, including General Jawan, worked on this together in the Clinton administration, in the George W. Bush administration, and Evelyn, you did, in the Obama administration. These countries in Central Europe wanted to be part of the EU, and they wanted to be part of NATO. And we were happy to take them in. We filled that security void in Central Europe, left with the collapse of the Warsaw Pact. Imagine where we would be today had we not expanded NATO into the Baltic states. I think President Putin would have his forces right up on the Narva River, separating Estonia and Russia, if not over the river. And those states would be threatened. And it's very important, I think historically very important decision by three American presidents, Democrat and Republican, to do this. I know there are a lot of people who want to blame us. This is another Putin line. If we hadn't expanded NATO, Putin wouldn't be Putin. I don't believe that for a minute. And so we should be proud of what we've created, and we should hold on to it, and we should strengthen it, and that's the opportunity that President Obama has.
Okay, thank you. That's very eloquent. General.
Thank you, Nick. I completely agree with the last statement with regard to the current Russian president who, in 2009, informed our president at a breakfast in Moscow that there was an agreement that NATO would never expand and take into its membership any of the former Warsaw Pact countries, and that we violated that agreement. We've been looking for the agreement, but somehow it's kind of hard to find. Somebody lost it somewhere. There was no such agreement, but it's interesting that the president of Russia actually deeply believes that there was such an agreement. So that complicates issue when you don't look at history the same way. On enlargement, I think one thing that NATO might want to consider is to take a look a little bit at the enlargement and the partnership program, because they're all kind of lumped together right now. And I think there are two vastly different things. I think it's for the alliance to determine when a new member is eligible and has met the requirements for membership. In my book, a new member should bring value to the alliance, not problems, but value. And we should have common values. And I think when NATO decides to do that, we should do that. On the partnership program that General Jawan started years ago, I think this is a potential for enormous influence. While people are waiting to become members, and that's their choice, the possibility of expanding the partnership program and the membership program for that particular aspect is off the page. And it ought not to be limited to just European countries, but I would suggest that it may be possible to reach out to moderate Arab states, even African countries, even countries in the Far East, who want to have interoperability with NATO and common tactics, training, and procedures to respond when needed across the board in the family of threats, from humanitarian missions to other kind of missions. And I think it's important to do that. When you think about the Middle East, you think about a collection of countries that have common language, generally common religion, common values, common culture, and you kind of wonder if NATO could be an interesting example for them to follow as an organization. NATO could be very helpful in helping Arab states develop their own kind of security treaty organization. So I'm for enlargement, and I'm also for taking a look at the Partnership for Peace program. On the hybrid question, it's a very interesting question, and it's one that we really haven't addressed very well. And this is where I think NATO and the EU could really work together, because part of the missioning in that type of so-called warfare would be definitely in the EU's wheelhouse. So this is something I think that we should work on. I think NATO ought not to be impervious to cybersecurity threats, and also energy security, and even economic security. That would be part of the dialogue. One of the responses that I think would be very meaningful and would certainly send a message to the Russian president is the construction of a north-south corridor from the Baltics to the Adriatic for transportation, telecommunications, and energy. And this is not a pie-in-the-sky dream. This is actually ongoing in the dialogue in the EU and in Washington with very favorable support. It involves freeing 13 to 14 different countries and reducing their dependence on Russian energy, for example. This would be a long-term consequence to Mr. Putin's actions in the Ukraine and in the Crimea, which I think are well worth considering. And this is a kind of a hybrid type of response to Russian aggression in those two areas, and I think would have tremendous impact on Russian thinking in terms of doing it elsewhere. And lastly, on Syria, I've actually believed that a few years ago we might have had an opportunity to perhaps forestall certainly the tremendous migration problems that are now squarely faced by the Europeans. And that's by borrowing a page from Operation Provide Comfort in northern Iraq in 1991. Had we been more forceful in enforcing the red line, I think that we could have created, along with our NATO partners and moderate Arab states, a humanitarian zone, no-fly zone, whatever you want to call it, as a consequence to President Assad's use of chemical weapons on his own people. And I think you could have had a safe zone for refugees, and I think you could have taken a pretty significant chunk of Syria. And with the military capability of NATO and the Arab states and the United States, I think you could have really forestalled this, the immigration or the migration problem that we've had, and who knows what could have happened. I'm not sure it's off the page completely. I know there's a lot of different views about that.
I was going to ask you that. You preempted me, yeah. Is it possible today?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated because of the Russian presence. Back then, there was no Russian presence, but I wouldn't completely dismiss it. So, thank you.
Can I just
Thank
add
you.
To that?
Yeah, please.
I think it's hard to envision NATO as a whole going into Syria simply because we operate by consensus. So each of the 28 mm-hmm. allies would have to agree, which is not going to happen.
Right.
But if the humanitarian situation worsens, and think of the data point at the beginning of the war in April 2011, the UN thought there were about 22.5 million Syrian citizens. Over 12 million of them are now homeless. 7 million inside the country, 5 million outside the country. Should that situation worsen, and Assad now says he wants to reclaim the entire country, Russia and Iran supporting him militarily, Russia, I think, violating mm-hmm. the assurances it gave the United States and the other Western countries about how it would act, then that humanitarian imperative, I think, at some point demands that we ask, what can we do? We don't want to put a big American land army there.
Right.
We've learned our lesson from Iraq. But do we have a humanitarian obligation to try to help the UN create humanitarian corridors? And Jim focused on exactly this issue. How do you help the people who are refugees, who are starving? Well, there's a Syrian-Jordanian border, and there's a Syrian-Turkish border, two possible places for a safe zone. I don't think we should give up on that idea. It's tremendously complicated. There are 80 reasons not to do it. But if that 12 million number becomes 13 or 14 million, you get into a situation where I think we were in Bosnia in the summer and autumn of 1995 after Srebrenica. You have to act.
Yes. Yes.
And you have to challenge the Russians to help us. And that ought to be the first call. And let's see what they say. See how cynical they are about all those lives being lost in Syria.
I don't think we
can't stop talking about
yeah.
this.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. Yeah. I mean, it's been my feeling for a while, having worked in Bosnia right after the war and studied it and written about it. And of course, you were both actively engaged in diplomacy and in your military careers at the time, so you know what it looked like in 94, 95, and I think we're exactly there with Syria. And sometimes, even if you don't know how you're going to resolve the conflict, you still have a responsibility. It's still incumbent upon you to do something to alleviate the suffering.
Absolutely.
And even there, we did have those safe zones, which didn't work. I shouldn't say they didn't work. They didn't work in every case. I actually ended up in Gorazde, one of the safe areas that survived. But okay, well, I think this has been incredibly informative. Dynamic, I think. I don't know whether it's spicy yet, but you guys have a chance to spice it up, make it a little more interesting. So I think there are probably people out there with microphones, and I will maybe call on folks. I'll try to be democratic, so I'll take right here from the front.
Ambassador Jim Cunningham.
Hi,
get
Jim.
Ready on that side of the room.
Jim Cunningham, Atlantic Council. Thank you for the report and for the recommendations. In order to try to be a little bit provocative, given the events of the last couple years in the European Union and NATO's own difficulties, given the fact that we have an administration now that only has 8 months left in office, and with the British having now decided to withdraw and all the knock-on effects that that's going to have in the European Union and in NATO, because they may be separate organizations, but they're not separate entities. They're intimately related, as all of us who've worked with NATO realize. And given the fundamental question, do we actually anymore have shared values and a shared view of what our way of life is? That's certainly underlying part of the debate in the United States and part of the debate in the UK and Europe, East and West and North and South among the alliance members. So my question is, do you think it's possible to restore the power and purpose of the alliance? That's exactly the right question.
Thank you.
Jim, thank you. And for those of you who don't know, Jim Cunningham was our great American diplomat and most recently our ambassador to Afghanistan. And our report, and we left this out, and I apologize, our report urges the alliance to stay in Afghanistan. I know that you feel deeply about that. And when Damon and I met with Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg at NATO last Tuesday, he assured us that NATO was staying in. The defense ministers had taken that position a week before. I assume the heads of government will do that. Jim, I think that you've put your finger on the central issue about NATO. We're many things. We're a military organization. We're collective defense. We're a political alliance. There's a political arm of NATO. But we're bound together by shared democratic values. And that's who we are. We don't invite countries in that are not democratic. One of the things we say, and if you look at the end of the executive summary, if you only want to read a couple of pages, we made it easier for you, is we're concerned about some of the populism, nativism, right-wing nationalism that's occurring in Europe. Look at Viktor Orban. Look at the questions people have of the new Polish government. I'll just speak for myself. We've got some of that going on in our country, nativism, populism, in the person of Donald Trump.
I'm comfortable with you speaking for me as well.
It's okay? Okay. And here's a candidate for the presidency who questions whether the United States should continue to be in NATO, who's threatened the NATO allies that if they don't pay up, he's going to walk out on them. And so I think the answer to your question is we need presidential leadership. We've always needed American presidential leadership. We are the outsized country in that alliance. We're up to 75% of the defense spending. We'd like to reduce that ratio and have the Europeans contribute more. And I think President Obama, in the wake of the Brexit vote, has a responsibility, but also an opportunity for him and for the United States to show our faith in NATO and to show our faith in the United Kingdom and to show our faith in a stronger leadership role for Germany. I certainly, having looked at this over the last several months and working through the report, believe that we need a stronger Germany, stronger militarily, stronger politically. I would say that Angela Merkel is probably the most respected leader of all the great powers right now. And so the relationship between the American president and the German chancellor, with the British exiting, if that's what happens, the European Union becomes central to everything that the United States needs to do in Europe. But it does get back to values. And I admire President Obama very much. And I hope that he can give that ringing speech, declaration at NATO of American commitment. And if there are any doubts in our country, Trump may be in a minority of one, actually, about NATO, then the president can speak to that. And I'm proud to say that Hillary Clinton is definitely standing up for the NATO alliance and everything she's doing as a candidate.
General, do you want to address the values? Let me
just add one caveat to that. It's not only about paying your way. I mean, you should do what you agreed to do. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But I think the American public is no longer willing to be the only ones who do the majority of the fighting and the dying in these missions. I think NATO allies are going to have to step up to the combat roles, not just the combat service support roles. And a lot of them do.
Pardon me? Georgia. Even partners like Georgia.
Exactly.
Or Finland.
Yeah.
Or
Finland. Exactly. So we have, I mean, a lot of them do, but it would be much better if everyone did. And so it's one of the difficulties of a 28 nation, maybe even 30 in the near future. One of the big challenges is getting everybody to agree to the same thing. And I think you're going to have a more agile voting capability for. Some allies want to do things, and others want to sit it out, like we did in Libya. I think you're going to have to have that agility, because if you insist on unanimity, as Nick pointed out several times, it's going to be very difficult. But I do think that it's fair to say that some of our allies need to not only step up financially, but also step up to the troop commitment to do the hard work.
Okay. Do we have a question from this side of the room? Maybe we'll start with the gentleman here. And then I promise I'll go to the back and be democratic.
Alexis Sapchenko, Private Citizen. My question is, what could NATO do for Ukraine in order to help this country to become closer to the Western alliance, and what Ukraine should do in order to become closer and approachable? Thank you.
Well,
go ahead, Ambassador.
Then over to you. We both wore our NATO ties today, by the way. That's quite
that's excellent, nice, yeah.
So I think one of the big policy questions for us, for the United States and for NATO, is what is the extent of our support for Ukraine? Ukraine has very sound political support from the NATO alliance about what happened to it, the dismemberment of its own country. You know, annexing Crimea is crossing the brightest red line in the UN Charter. So I think they felt that political support, but they haven't felt the military support. I believe that we should provide lethal assistance to Ukraine. I think the Ukrainians deserve that, and they have a right to defend their country. But that's a policy question that, you know, President Obama has answered the negative on that. And so we'll have to continue to debate that in our country. On Ukraine and NATO, we have been partners for a long time. We've had a formal relationship going all the way back to when Jim and I, before Jim and I arrived at NATO, just in the last decade. Ukraine has a long way to go, obviously, to be considered for membership in NATO because of the territorial divisions, because of the corruption, because of some of the lapses in democracy. So I just, we don't call in this report for Ukraine to be admitted next month to NATO. But I certainly believe what all of our presidents have believed, and that is Ukraine has a right to think about a future with NATO, to work towards that future. The timeline, of course, who knows? It depends on events in Ukraine itself. But let me just finish by going back to a point that I made earlier. It's very important that we signal to the Russian Federation that Russia has no veto over who joins NATO. That even if Russia invades countries, Georgia and Ukraine, that's not going to stop NATO countries from working with them and having a relationship with which at some point could or could not turn into membership. A lot will depend on the Ukrainians themselves and whether Ukraine can build a fully fledged democracy. And let's hope that it can.
Do you want to add anything, General?
Okay.
Well, I'll just add that I think Ukrainian government has passed a lot of really good legislation lately. So the question will be now on implementation, and I'll just leave it at that. But I'm feeling bullish this week.
Good.
Okay, so back of the room. It's hard for me to see, but I'll just go the furthest back on the right with the two fingers up.
I'm Bob Bradke, and Nick, it's good to see you. Nick, I think many of us in this room remember a time when the slogan in this town about NATO was out of area or out of business. I wonder whether, looking back, we allowed ourselves to be distracted, that it was that kind of thinking that led us to pull our major land forces out of Germany, that would let us to take on a lot of small missions that really weren't central to NATO's purpose, weren't central to Article 5. I wonder now whether, as we look ahead, we need to be careful about making that mistake, that NATO should not be the tool for dealing with migration issues, that we need to be careful about NATO's training missions, about expanding NATO's role in the Middle East. I wonder whether we need to keep our focus on NATO as a self-defense organization focused on Europe.
Okay, actually, I'm noticing that we only have about 15 minutes left, so I'm going to maybe bundle up a couple of questions with the consent of my colleagues here. Margaret Warner.
Hi, thank you both for doing this. Margaret Warner from the PBS NewsHour. There's been a lot of talk about, of course, after the Brexit vote, that the U.S. is going to lose a vigorous friend in the EU if it goes forward. How do you think that, if at all, would affect Britain's role in NATO, and in particular, how muscular a partner it has been for the U.S., not only militarily, missions, but just viewpoint?
Okay, and one more from this side. The gentleman in the front.
Just to follow up, I'm Bill Drozdiak, to follow up on Margaret's point. Could you envision an organic relationship between NATO and the EU, such as a joint policy planning council, in order to consider threats to European allies that could be dealt with by both institutions, since 22 out of 28 members are members of both?
Okay, thank you. Let's take those three, if that's okay, and then we'll go back to this side of the room.
I want to salute Bob Bradke, who is a pivotal figure at the State Department for NATO enlargement in the last decade. Bob asked the first question. Bob, I agree with the thrust of your question, what I found implicit in your question, that we're not back to the Cold War, thankfully, but we're back to a dotted line redivision of Europe by Putin, south and west of the Russian Federation. And if our core responsibility in NATO is to protect the people and the countries in the alliance, then we have the primary goal has to be effective deterrence against Russia going forward, given what Putin has done. And as you imply, that means we can't do everything and we can't be in every mission around the world. You have to choose. I would say that we made the right decision to go into Bosnia in September, October of 1995, and we stopped the war, and then held the peace, and didn't lose a single soldier to combat death. And General Jawan was a huge part of that. And then we made the right decision to go into Kosovo to stop the annihilation of the Kosovar Albanian population by Milosevic and the Serb army. So I'm proud of those two first big out-of-area missions that NATO undertook. And frankly, I think we were right to put NATO into Afghanistan as a collective mission in August of 2003 is when we deployed. And we believe in this report that we should stay there. It's a longer subject. Margaret, on your question, the big loss if Britain is permanently out, and even if Britain splinters and weakens and is consumed by internal angst, the big loss will be Britain's voice in the EU, because we tend to share a common strategic outlook with Britain. But you're right to focus on NATO. Britain, I think Jim will be a better judge of this, second strongest country in the alliance, so the United States, and a country willing to deploy and willing to fight. Jim talked about that. The British certainly have done that in Afghanistan as well as in Iraq. So we really do need a strong Britain in NATO. And given some of the, you know, we argue everything in NATO, and we operate by consensus, so sometimes you argue for years. Britain's a voice of reason and of strength, and we need that voice in NATO, I think, going forward. And I just say to Bill's question, Bill Drozdiak, Jim has been, I think, ringing the village bell on NATO-EU, and he's right to. We ought to envision a joint council between NATO and the EU. That would bring the United States into institutional linkage with the European Union, which we desperately need at a time when the British may be withdrawing.
General?
I would just add on the core mission question. Certainly, that's what it was in the 20th century up to the end of the Cold War. I'm not sure in this globalized world of rapidly occurring things and non-state actors and rise of terrorism and entire countries that could be overtaken by that kind of ideology that we can afford to have a NATO that's just sitting waiting for something to happen within the borders of NATO. I just don't think that's in the cards. If NATO is going to be, you know, the main contributor to our collective security. And I think while you can't do everything, there are certain events that are coming towards us that mandate that we pay attention to them, unless we want to have another Afghanistan or another Iraq, and we want to fight somewhere for another 10 years. So to me, proactive consideration is cheaper, it's more effective, and it's a big training mission, really, with partners and allies. But you could prevent any number of countries from being overwhelmed by radical ideologies that will seek to transform their societies against us, by the way. We're the collective bad guys here for all of this radical fundamentalism that's going on. And so I think they should be engaged, and I think they should be engaged in a way that is less expensive and would yield better results. You're not going to have economic development and freedom and governance and rule of law unless you have security. And NATO is the penultimate security organization there is. And it should be emulated, should be copied, it should be admired. And wherever we can, we should export it.
Do you want to say anything about Britain's role in NATO?
Well, I think Britain's role in NATO is a matter of record. I mean, it is, I think, along with France, probably the two most powerful militaries there are. And I think that their role in NATO will continue. I'd like to see the UK stiffen up a little bit and get up to that agreed upon percentage, or certainly not go below it. But I think they have a very important role, and I think maybe even more so now with this exit.
Yeah, and I'll also make a linkage with Ukraine. The Brits, together with us and the Canadians, we're basically the top three training the Ukrainian troops right now, which is really the number one form of deterrence that we're giving Ukraine vis-a-vis Russia. So
I wouldn't want to be misunderstood on the question of proactivity. I'm not advocating for, you know, unwanted military involvement. I'm advocating for training type missions to help countries seal their borders, to help them defend themselves, to help train the militaries of how to function under civilian leadership, and to encourage the growth of democracy and economic development and And I think you would avoid many future conflicts by being there a little bit earlier.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's great. You're also speaking for me. let's take on the aisle there. And I'll do again in three of them. So on the aisle, up here, and maybe right over there in the middle.
I'm Timothy Towle, a retired U.S. ambassador and a colleague of Nick's, 31 years in the State Department. I thought this was fabulous, General and Nick, and it's important that these ambassadors and newsmen get the word out because it's very important for NATO. My question is for my friend Nick. You listed three or four things that are vital. Three of them get the attention of everybody. Racy things like exercises, stationing permanent troops on sovereign countries over there. Wow. A stronger NATO, I can hear the music. But then you talked about sanctions. Well, that gets pushed back on the business section of the New York Times sometimes, and people ignore it. I wonder if whether you and everybody else here shouldn't flack that, because you talked about those business as usual pro-Russian types. How about that? You mentioned Donald Trump. I wasn't, but you mentioned it, so I'm going to mention it. On TV 3 weeks ago, somebody asked him about Brexit, and he said, "What's that? I don't know what it is. I'll get back to you." And now he's over there selling hotel rooms in Scotland and talking as if this is the end of the world. Why don't we push the sanctions bit and point out that his new wizard, Montefort, is a lawyer that does business in Russia and loves Putin. The rest of us have to register as foreign agents because we're not lawyers. Lawyers down on K Street here can run around and do everything without registering. Why don't you go after the Trump crowd for sucking up to Russia rather than protecting the United States of America and our NATO allies?
Okay, thank you. That was a very good forceful,
spicy
question.
A lot of spice in
okay,
that question.
over there. Ariel, I think.
Good afternoon, Ariel Cohen, the Atlantic Council. The question is region-specific. We have a mission and a coordination in the Baltic region. What about the Black Sea? In the Black Sea, you have disparate militaries, disparate countries. You have Romania, Bulgaria, Turkey as NATO members. You have Georgia and Ukraine as potential NATO allies, but not currently members. What kind of coordinating structure would you recommend to create, and maybe as a recommendation for the NATO summit? Because otherwise, it is not clear to me how do you coordinate the air, sea, and ground and space elements of that, and what is the time frame you would be looking at to implement that. Thank you very much.
And I will note onto that General Breedlove, I don't know if it was here or elsewhere, but he talked about a Black Sea need for Black Sea security initiative. So I think maybe you're hinting towards that. Okay, a third question, let's take from over here. Sorry. And this will be, hello. I think, our last question because we need time to answer.
Hi, I'm Denton Nong with the Hudson Institute. My question is, you know, with the number of active duty U.S. military declining to about 450,000-ish and, you know, sequestration really hurting the U.S. budget, and with President Obama's pivot to Asia well underway, how can the United States reassure our European allies without becoming overextended in multiple regions around the world? And how can we balance our priorities while still deterring Russia, especially when they have exercises with up to 100,000 troops sometimes?
Okay, thank you very much. Ambassador, please.
Okay, I think I'm going to, I think Jim has thought a lot about the Black Sea and has just been there. So I'm going to punt that question to my friend Jim Jones. But on the other two questions, Ambassador Towle, thank you for your question. We do highlight the sanctions issue in this report. It's one of our major recommendations that we be tough-minded about maintaining the sanctions on the Russian Federation. Obviously, Chancellor Merkel and President Obama and the other leaders made the correct decision when Putin went into Crimea and the Donbass not to fight. We have no Article 5 obligation to Ukraine. Ukraine's not a member. We don't want a war with the Russian Federation. But we had to have a response that was going to be effective, and sanctions was the response. And now to see at least three European Union leaders imply or state unequivocally that they think it's time to end the sanctions before Putin has met any of the conditions for ending the sanctions, would be giving a victory to Putin and encouraging him towards further mayhem and territorial aggrandizement in Europe. And so this is a very important principle. And I'm quite confident the Obama administration is going to hold the line on this. And from what I heard in Germany last week, Chancellor Merkel intends to. That's a very good start. But everybody in the EU has to agree to pitch the sanctions forward, to continue them. So it's going to be a real battle in Europe. And as I said, smack in the middle of our presidential transition. In our conversations last week, as private citizens, both Damon and I advised some of these Europeans, don't challenge the United States during a presidential transition. Don't challenge our outgoing president or our incoming president. I mean, do the right thing and continue the sanctions. On the last question, as a civilian, I certainly don't want to see us cut the defense budget. I think the pivot, the rebalancing to Asia is the right idea. And President Obama is right to build up American resources in Guam at Anderson Air Force Base, Darwin, Australia, in Japan and South Korea. It was impressive to see two U.S. carriers and their associated ships go through in international waters the South China Sea last week. That makes a big statement, but you've got to have a healthy defense budget to do that. We're big enough, we're wealthy enough, and we're a global leader. So in rebalancing to Asia, there's no contradiction in pivoting back to Europe. We hollowed out, in a way, our military in Europe to fight the Afghan and Iraq wars. And I very strongly support what Ash Carter has done to convince Congress that he can use $3.4 billion of defense funds to rebuild the American military in Poland, the Baltic states, and on our bases in Europe. We need to do more of that if we're going to have effective strategic deterrence against Putin.
And put it into the regular budget.
And put it in not just a one-off deal, yeah, but put it into the regular budget so that we have enough money to finance a bigger American military presence in Europe, which is very welcome by the Europeans, by the way,
yeah,
as you know.
General.
One of my favorite sayings is virtual presence is actual absence. And and by that I mean that if you want to be a superpower, you're going to have to be a superpower. And you can't just pick and choose where you want to be a superpower. So all this discussion about pivoting and rebalancing and all this other stuff is just kind of restating the obvious, in my view. I think most Americans really want this country to have the same type of primacy in terms of what goes on in the globe in 2050 as we did in 1950. And if that's the case, then withdrawing from the world withdrawing from regions will create vacuums. And vacuums are filled by people that don't have your best interests at heart. You've seen that recently in the Middle East with Russia. And we've seen it in different other places as well. So, you know, the next administration is going to have to get on board fully with the fact of where is it you want to take this country and where do you want this country to be? And places like the Black Sea are important, and they're important not only militarily and strategically, they're important economically. And one of the things that I've noticed is that there's a different dialogue when you talk to Eastern Europeans these days and Western Europeans. Western Europeans seem to be much more willing to forgive and find a reason to say, well, they didn't say it or they didn't mean it, or you know, maybe we shouldn't do the sanctions. But if you go to Eastern Europe, you won't get that. You don't get that at all. And having just come back from Romania, I was very pleased to discover on my arrival there that 700 U.S. Marines were training on Romanian bases that we actually got them to modernize back in 2006 when we were in NATO together. And same in Bulgaria. So if you go to those countries and you talk about how serious they think the threat is, you get the same kind of rhetoric that the Germans and the British and the French were talking about in 1950, when there was still when there was a Cold War. So the United States, I think, finds itself as a global power, not focused only on an east-west strategy, which has dominated our thinking for the last 70 years or so, but also having to think about new realities in our own hemisphere, but also the rise of the African continent is a reality that is going to be upon us before you think. And so we have to be engaged as a global power, and we cannot withdraw. It's in our own national interest. It's not because we're magnanimous and we want to do good things all over the world, but it's in our own national interest to be able to do that. It's our inheritance, really, from the 20th century. But it's a different world, and we have to organize ourselves differently. We have to be more agile. I've talked about the National Security Council, and not too facetiously, in the sense that we need a 24-hour National Security Council, because you can't afford to go to sleep in this world, because the next day you go to work and you're dealing with everything that happened during the 6 or 7 hours you caught up on your sleep. So this is a different world. It's a different century. The institutions that were organized for the Cold War are having a difficult time reacting with the speed and in meeting the variety of the challenges. They're economic, they're energy, it's climate, and it's conventional military, and it's non-nation state actors, and the whole bit. So I think we really have to figure out how we're going to do all the things that we want to do. And that's going to take some reorganization, I think, in our government and the way we do things. I found it much easier to deal with regions than dealing with single countries. You can understand the world a lot better if you think regionally. We tend to have a mindset of dealing with countries from Washington individually through soda straws. But I believe with the unified commands that we have, which is another inheritance from the 20th century, that we could have regional strategies with regional representation by a whole of government and the military, forward-based in different regions, and I think you could engage much more successfully there. The Black Sea is a good area for that, and it's a very serious issue, and I hope this summit deals with it.
Well, thank you very much. First of all, you've ranged very proactively, well beyond even NATO and the NATO periphery, to Asia and to regional combatant commands, et cetera. I think this has been a very engaging discussion. The report is proactive. We're trying to keep it spicy. Let's go on the road and do more of this. I hope you gentlemen maybe think about doing more TV and op-eds. And I just really want to say also thank you, both of you, for your leadership and for your long years of work in the field, obviously your service, and hopefully we can keep you talking about all these issues. So please join me in a round of applause.
Thank you for listening to the Atlantic Council Events Podcast. For more information, please visit our website at atlanticcouncil.org and follow us on Twitter @AtlanticCouncil. The Atlantic Council, working together to secure the future.